Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Melvin Rhodes. I live in Lansing, Michigan. And I know that I am in Seattle, or at least the area around Seattle. Mr. Weber didn't know where he was, so, but I know. You know, this last week I was in Lansing. In fact, the last two weeks I was in Lansing for church. The week after that, I was in Preston in England, and the week before that, I was in Kumasi in Ghana. So I often don't know where I am. And it's particularly a problem in the middle of the night because I never know where I am, and I walk into all kinds of things if I have to get up in the middle of the night. And one night, just in October, my wife and I had stopped in Germany on the way back from West Africa. And in the middle of the night, I didn't want to disturb her. So I didn't turn on the light, and somehow I ended up entangled in coat hangers in the wardrobe. And while I was trying to disentangle myself, of course, my wife woke me up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Don't ask. Don't ask. Just help me get out of here, because I need to go somewhere." So, anyway, it's good to be here. I'll just say this, be careful coming up to me. I picked up something, I've got the flu or something, so I don't want to pass on my germs to you, so I recommend no hugs and kisses or anything else, but it's entirely up to you. But do so at your own risk. Anyway, you'd have to be over 70 years of age to remember a time when the world was not dominated by the United States. I've been reading a book called Picking Up the Reins, which I actually quoted from in the latest Good News magazine. It's written by a man called Norman Moss. Norman Moss is a journalist and historian, and the book is about how power was transferred from the British Empire to the United States after World War II. Prior to World War II, the British were the number one power in the world. In fact, just before World War II, when the King and Queen came over for a visit to the United States and Canada, when they were staying at the White House, Franklin Roosevelt reminded the King that Britain, or the British Empire, was America's first line of defense. And so the United States was looking to Britain to fulfill its traditional role. And this was just, I think, a month before World War II started. But World War II did change a great deal. And there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from what happened to the British Empire, the decline and fall of the British Empire. There are a lot of parallels today with what's happening to the United States, and you'll see them as I go through this presentation. If you look at Genesis chapter 48, we read here in Genesis chapter 48 an account of how Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, received a blessing from their grandfather, Jacob, also called Israel. Now, most people in the world today, when they think of Israel, they think automatically of the Jews in the Middle East. But the Jews are only one of the tribes of Israel, Judah. 10 of the tribes of Israel, 10 of the sons of Israel, their descendants, just disappeared. They formed a separate kingdom from Judah shortly after David was king. And later on, they were taken into captivity. They were conquered by the Assyrians. And then they just disappeared from history. And officially, historians don't know what happened to them. Now, if you look at Genesis chapter 48, you see a prophecy that is very applicable to our time. In verse 15, it says, "He blessed Joseph and said, 'God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, let my name be named upon them.'" Now this is Israel speaking, the father of Joseph, the father of the 12 sons who are the patriarchs of Israel. And he's saying, "Let my name," his name Israel, "be named upon the lads," upon the two boys of Joseph, not upon Judah. Now, the other sons were still a part of Israel, and sometimes prophecies can relate to all of the tribes, but here, special mention was being made of Joseph's sons, and the name of Israel was being placed upon them. And so often when we look at prophecies relating to Israel, it's not talking about the Jews. The Jews are the tribe of Judah. And there are many prophecies about Judah at the end time prior to the return of Jesus Christ. There are also prophecies about Israel. And Israel has a separate identity from Judah. Let my name be named upon them and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. The Jews never became a multitude. They were never numerically all that great. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, because Manasseh was the oldest, and according to the law of primogeniture, or the custom of primogeniture at the time, the oldest son received the bulk of the birthright blessing. So when he laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations," lots of different countries. If our one translation even uses the term a commonwealth of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Now we believe, and we're not the only ones who believe this, that this prophecy was fulfilled thousands of years later in the United States, which was the great single nation descended from Manasseh, and also the British Empire and Commonwealth, which was the multitude of nations descended from Ephraim. In fact, if you continue into the next chapter, chapter 49, you'll see that all of this is relevant in the latter days. It says, "Jacob called his sons and said, gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." So this prophecy has relevance today. Now, previous generations, many people understood this in previous generations. In fact, the idea of what is sometimes referred to as Anglo-Israelism or British Israelism really became quite popular in the 1800s, in the time of Queen Victoria, around 1840. Victoria became queen in 1837. And in 1840, a book was published explaining all of this. Now, the idea actually went back earlier than that, but it really took off in the Victorian period for a number of reasons. One was the British Empire was expanding so rapidly, people could see right in front of them, right before their eyes, in their newspapers every day, the fulfillment of this particular prophecy. And the United States, of course, at the same time, was expanding westwards. The United States had broken away from Britain, from the multitude of nations that was united by the crown, and the United States was becoming what Winston Churchill described as the Great Republic, the single nation that was separate from all the other nations that were a part of the multitude of nations. Now, after World War II, with the end of the British Empire, the idea basically died down because people felt that it couldn't possibly be true because things had gone wrong. The British Empire was coming to an end. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't true. And there's no other way in which this prophecy can have been fulfilled. The Jews never fulfilled this prophecy of a great single nation and a multitude of nations. And here it's talking about the end time. And we believe that we are living in that time period. Now, look at chapter 49 for a moment, and look at verse 22. Because in chapter 49, we see a prophecy relating to all 12 of the tribes of Israel, describing how they would be in the latter days. And in verse 22, you'll notice that Ephraim and Manasseh are not mentioned. In fact, rather, it says Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. And when you look at the history of the last 300 years, you can see just how productive Joseph has been. The British, the Americans, have been so productive in developing countries around the globe and the wealth which has been achieved in our own history. Joseph is a fruitful bough. Now, the significance of the word Joseph here is this. If you want to understand what is happening prophetically, you need to look at Britain and the United States together, not separately. The big mistake most historians make is looking at them separately. So you have historians who specialize in the United States and see the United States as a country that was unique and suddenly appeared on the world scene in 1789, once the Constitution and everything was put together. Before that, nothing mattered. And that's not the way to look at history. When you look at British and American history together, and some historians have done this, Winston Churchill famously wrote his History of the English-Speaking Peoples that was published in 1955. And there have been others as well who've looked at the two histories together. And when you look at them together, you see things that you would never see if you only looked at American history, or alternatively, if you only looked at British history. You see far more and come to understand more about where we are now in terms of Bible prophecy. And Joseph has played a major role on the world scene in the last 300 years and continues to play a major role. But things are changing, as we'll see throughout this presentation. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well, meaning, you know, you've got a well there, there's water in the well, the fruitful bough, is the greenery is just spreading out from that well, because Joseph has been so productive. And you can go to so much of the world and see the many countries that have been developed by the descendants of the peoples of Joseph. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. There's been many conflicts during the time of the British ascendancy first, and then America's ascendancy. Many conflicts in areas where people have tried to become dictators and conquer vast areas, and we've had to go to war. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. So God has been helping us through this period of time. The title of my presentation is, "And Thus He Set Ephraim, the British Empire, Before Manasseh, the United States." And we'll have a look at that now. In fact, let me put a map up on the screen, which will help you to see things. This is a map. This is how it was, basically, when I was born, which is really not that long ago. But you know, everything colored red there was the British Empire. And for the benefit of those of you who went to public school, the blue bit up there is the United States. Just a joke there. Anyway, that's the British Empire, United States, okay? Some people have difficulty, you know. I saw a survey of 14-year-olds that I think it was 20% couldn't find the United States on the map. So, I don't know, maybe there's one here. But anyway, that's a map of the world as it was. This is a map roughly at the end of World War II, 1946. Okay? So it's not that long ago. Some of you were alive back in 1946. Now, sometimes, because the British Empire has kind of receded into history, sometimes now people claim we've got it the wrong way round, that Ephraim is the United States, because the United States is much more powerful. And, you know, Manasseh is Britain. But understand, it doesn't work the other way around, because Britain without its empire is nothing. Really, it's nothing. It doesn't amount to anything. It's of no significance. And also, it doesn't work the other way around, because if Ephraim was before Manasseh and the United States is Ephraim, then Britain's greatest period still has to come. And I can't imagine that Britain could have something greater than what it had with its empire. And there's other reasons too. In fact, I've written this up in an article for the next World News and Prophecy, so I'll let you look at all the reasons then. But the British Empire in the 19th century was extremely powerful. Historian James Morris described it vividly in his book Pax Britannica that was published in 1968. The 19th century, Queen Victoria was queen from 1837 to 1901, so she was queen for most of the 19th century. The 19th century had been preeminently Britain's century. Ever since the triumphant conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars, they had seemed to be arbiters of the world's affairs, writing a balance here, dismissing a potentate there, ringing the earth with railways and submarine cables, lending money everywhere, peopling the empty places with men of the British stock, grandly revenging wrongs, converting pagans, discovering unknown lakes, setting up dynasties, emancipating slaves, winning wars, putting down mutinies, keeping Turks in their place, and building bigger and faster battleships, and in their spare time they play cricket. That was the 19th century, okay, Britain's century. But Britain remained the preeminent power until well into the 20th century. And in fact, when the U.S. and Britain were at war in World War II, President Roosevelt, you can read about this in the book Picking Up the Reins, President Roosevelt told Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister at the time in Britain, he said that after the war he wanted all American troops brought home within 2 years. Now, 65 years later, American troops are still in Europe. Not as many as there were back then, but there's still quite a few. So, you know, what went wrong? Basically, at the end of World War II, the U.S. expected Britain to continue its traditional role as what was called the world's policeman. That's what the Pax Britannica was all about, the British peace. America just wanted the British to continue to fulfill that role, which was, as FDR pointed out to the King in 1939, America's first line of defense. But it wasn't to be quite that simple. In 1940, at the time of the Battle of Britain, when Britain was being attacked every night by Nazi Germany, and the United States was still neutral, James Truslow Adams, who was an American historian of great renown, well-respected, he died in 1948, James Truslow Adams wrote A History of the British Empire from 1789 to 1939. And he wrote this at the end of his book. This was the final paragraph, and it was a chilling warning to Americans of the dangers of remaining neutral during this conflict, World War II. He said, "The possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe scarcely thinkable. Not only would it leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe into which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush, but the strongest bulwark outside ourselves for our own safety and freedom would have been destroyed." That was a very prophetic paragraph, because that is exactly what has happened in the last 65 years since the end of World War II. In fact, you just look at that map for a moment, if I can get the pointer here. Everything colored red was the British Empire. The British pulled out of Palestine. In Palestine, the British kept the Jews and the Palestinians under control, not completely, because that would be impossible, but basically they kept them under control. But in 1948, the British had to pull out. And even today, 62 years later, that is still the most tense area of the world, and potentially the place where World War III will start. In fact, Bible prophecy shows that Jerusalem is the very center of Bible prophecy. That was not true 100 years ago. 100 years ago, that whole area was ruled by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire. It was at peace. In fact, I have a quote in a book at home from an Englishman living in what is now Iraq. At that time, it was Mesopotamia, a province of the Ottoman Empire. And he wrote home in 1910, 100 years ago exactly, and said, "This must be the most boring place in the world. Nothing ever happens here." And Winston Churchill, around the same time, also wrote about how the Middle East was a backwater of no significance whatsoever to the world. But it became the most dangerous neighborhood in the world after the end of the British Empire, because there was no one to keep it under control, if you want to put it that way. Look at another area that you hear about on your news every day. The northwest frontier of Pakistan, the border with Afghanistan, where all the tribes are that are constantly causing the problems that our troops and British troops and Canadian troops are faced with on a daily basis in that area. That was always the most dangerous part of the British Empire, the northwest frontier. But the British kept it basically under control for a couple of hundred years. But then, of course, the British pulled out in 1947. And now it's become a major problem again. And we're not able to bring it under control. We've been trying for how many years now? 8 years. And we still have not been able to bring it under control. Then a lot of these countries in Africa that were pacified under British rule have had civil wars during the past 50 years since they got their independence. Sudan has had a civil war that's gone on, I think, almost all the time since they got their independence in 1956. And a few years ago, a third of all the countries in Africa were in the middle of civil wars. So what James Truslow Adams said was very accurate. Now, 1 year after World War II, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff similarly advised the President, President Truman, the defeat or disintegration of the British Empire would eliminate from Eurasia, Europe and Asia, the last bulwark of resistance between the U.S. and Soviet expansion. Our present position as a world power is of necessity closely interwoven with that of Britain. So as far as the United States was concerned after World War II, there was a general feeling, you know, let's let the British take care of everything. The British Empire has been doing it for 200 years. Dean Acheson, in my book, he was the Undersecretary of State at the time, made the comment that the British had done it very competently for 200 years. Why did it all change after World War II? And what lessons are there for the United States today? It changed because Britain was broke. And you cannot police the world. You cannot have a big military unless you've got lots of money. And Britain was broke. Britain had fought two world wars in 25 years. And in World War II had fought on three fronts. In North Africa, in Europe, and also in Asia. And by the end of World War II, the country was broke. Now, nobody realized that initially. Also, after World War II, the British people had an election, and they turned out Winston Churchill, who was the leader of the Conservative Party, which is like the Republicans in the United States, and they opted instead for Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party, which is like the Democrats in the United States. And the Labour Party was determined to use a lot of that money that had been spent on policing the world to get this. Start a free healthcare system. And in 1947, when they had the worst winter on record in 1947, and just the cost of heating, of providing food and heat for everybody was so great that they had a national financial crisis, the government would not give up on its healthcare plans and instead decided that they had to withdraw from some of their military commitments. And in February of 1947, after helping the Greeks fight a war against the communists, Greece down here somewhere, excuse my hand shaking, but when they were fighting a war against the communists, the British had helped them with, at the time, that was a lot of money, £40 million, and also provided 9,000 troops. And they were fighting as well in Palestine, they were fighting as well in India, Pakistan. So British troops were overstretched. They were suffering from what historians today call imperial overstretch, or imperial overreach, which is where you have too many military commitments and not enough troops. And then they were also broke. So they decided, this was just a temporary problem in their minds, but they decided to inform the United States that they would be withdrawing from Greece a few weeks later. And that's what they did. And when Washington received the telegram, it blew Washington away. For two centuries, Britain had been the dominant power in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now it seemed to be surrendering that role in two key countries. The British were also cutting off aid to Turkey, which was also trying to stave off Soviet intervention in the country. It is often said that Americans lack a historical sense that Europeans have. But on this occasion, it was the Americans who saw the historical significance of the moment. To British ministers battling day to day to keep the country's head above water, this seemed just to be a temporary retrenchment in one area. None of them appeared to see any larger implication in the decision. The American view was put in grandiloquent terms by Joseph M. Jones, who was in the State Department at the time. Reading the messages, it was realized that Great Britain had, within the hour, handed the job of world leadership with all its burdens and all its glory to the United States. The date was February 21st, 1947, the day the United States effectively replaced Great Britain as the world's global superpower. So Ephraim had her greatness until that point. Now Manasseh was taking over as the preeminent nation in the world. But it wasn't to be quite as easy as that. Now understand that Britain's power, Britain had become the dominant nation, depending on how you look at it, you could say in 1759. 1759 was the year that the British defeated the French and drove them out of North America. Quebec, and if you remember, George Washington fired the first shot in the French and Indian War. And and that was the war in which General Wolfe captured Quebec. And so the French were kicked out of North America, and the whole of the eastern seaboard was speaking English from that time, became a part of the British Empire briefly. But from that time, 1759 until 1947, now that doesn't mean everything went smoothly in all that time. The French bounced back under Napoleon, who tried to take over the world. But then, after Napoleon, there was a 100-year period where the British had no serious contender. That period is known as the Pax Britannica, from 1815 to 1914, the British peace. But from the time that the United States replaced Britain as the number one nation, in relative terms, America was not to be as powerful, because immediately the United States had to contend with the Soviet Union. So there was a major rival immediately. Let me quote here from Dean Acheson, who was then the undersecretary at the U.S. Department of State. Dean Acheson, by the way, was very much an Anglophile. He came from a Tory family in New England. They celebrated the King's birthday every year, even though Dean Acheson was in the American government and the Truman administration. Dean Acheson said that Britain was so weakened financially that there were now only two great powers in the world. Not since Rome and Carthage in the second century BC, he said, had there been such a polarization of power. And it was between democracy and dictatorship, between democracy, the Western countries, dictatorship, the Eastern countries, the communist countries. So immediately the US became the number one power. Immediately there was this major problem with the Soviet Union. But the British weren't out of the picture yet. They still thought they would bounce back. Will Clayton, Assistant Secretary of State in May 1947, summed up the situation with these words: "The reins of world leadership are slipping from Britain's competent but now very weak hands. The reins will be picked up either by the United States or Russia." And then, of course, the Cold War started and lasted for over 40 years. And then briefly in the 1990s, with the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States enjoyed unrivaled power. But of course, it came to an end rather rapidly and dramatically on September the 11th in 2001, and things have not been the same since. What lessons can we learn from this? Well, first of all, let me just mention it was still a few years before Britain was out of the picture altogether. When Queen Elizabeth became queen 58 years ago today, as it happens, February 6th in 1952, Britain was still a major military power. The multitude of nations was still a major military force. And at the coronation of the Queen in June 1953, there were troops from all the different countries of the empire, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, India, Pakistan, and so on, all these troops there. And it still gave this impression of a great military power. But only 3.5 years after the coronation, it all fell apart. Because in 1956, the president of Egypt seized the Suez Canal, which had been built by the British and the French. The British, the French, and the Israelis all sent their troops in to get it back and to teach Nasser a lesson. And they actually won the war. But then President Eisenhower told the British to withdraw. And the British were faced with a dilemma because Eisenhower, by the way, was the only one in his cabinet who wanted the British to withdraw. Everybody else in the cabinet told Eisenhower to support Britain, but for some reason he didn't. And so he told the British to withdraw and said if they didn't, then he would flood the world's markets with British pounds, which would, you know, force a depreciation in the value of the British currency and ruin its international trading status. So Britain had no choice but to withdraw. As a result of that, the British learned a lesson, and that is that they could not do anything anymore without American support. And that was effectively the end of the British Empire. Within a decade, everything was gone. All those territories colored red were given independence. The French learned a different lesson. Just I'll mention this briefly. The French learned a lesson: you can never trust America, which is why the French, even today, are so suspicious of everything the United States does. They have longer memories than the British do. But that was 1956. That was effectively the end of the British Empire. But what you learn from that is, when you are dependent on other countries financially, you lose your independence. You cannot do what you want to do. They can pull the plug on you at any time. And the point is that the United States is now where Britain was at that time. We are in like January 1947. In fact, in February 1947, when the British had to hand over the reins of leadership to the US, they were going through the worst winter in their history. And they were talking on the news last night about this being the worst winter that anybody can remember, at least in the east of the United States. And it just made me think, I thought, yeah, maybe there's some significance here. Maybe not, I don't know. God moves in mysterious ways, but we'll come to that in a few moments. Paul Kennedy wrote a book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, in 1987. It's the definitive book on how nations rise and fall. And he looked at the nations that, since the year 1500, have reached the number one position, the preeminent position of being the world's greatest power. In the 1500s, it was the Habsburgs, you know, the basically Philip II of Spain, who sent his armada against England. And then after that, it was the French, and then after the French, the British, and then, of course, the United States. And he showed a commonality in the rise and fall of these nations. And we're concentrating on the fall just because of time restraints, not because of doom and gloom, Mr. Weber. We're trying to just focus on this particular point. But I want to show you that it's actually a positive thing before I finish today. But nations rise to greatness because they build up vast wealth. Spain got vast wealth after it conquered South America and took all the gold back to Spain. Then the French accumulated great wealth. The British were the greatest investors in history because of the Industrial Revolution. And of course, the United States has been a great investor since World War II. But Paul Kennedy showed there are two things that bring down the greatest power: debt. And he explains that a bit more by saying borrowing money from other nations to finance your wars. And secondly, imperial overreach, having too many military commitments and not enough troops. The United States suffers from both problems today. Neil Ferguson, who's one of my favorite historians, wrote this: "This is how empires decline. It begins with a debt explosion. It ends with an inexorable reduction in the resources available for the Army, Navy, and Air Force, which is why voters are right to worry about America's debt crisis. According to a recent Rasmussen report, 42% of Americans now say that cutting the deficit in half by the end of the president's first term should be the administration's most important task, significantly more than the 24% who see health care reform as the number one priority. But cutting the deficit in half is simply not enough. If the United States doesn't come up soon with a credible plan to restore the federal budget to balance over the next 5 to 10 years, the danger is very real that a debt crisis could lead to a major weakening of American power." That's from an article in Newsweek, November 28, titled "An Empire at Risk." Here's another one from the Wall Street Journal on Monday, February 2nd. Capital Journal, deficit balloons, international security threat. The U.S. government this year will borrow one of every $3 it spends, with many of those funds coming from foreign countries. That weakens America's standing and its freedom to act. It strengthens China and other world powers, puts long-term defense spending at risk, undermines the power of the American system as a model for developing countries, and reduces the aura of power that has been a great intangible asset for presidents for more than a century. Further down, it says this year, thanks in some measure to continuing high costs from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. will spend a once unthinkable $688 billion on defense. Before 9/11, the figure was closer to $300 billion. So you see how debt and imperial overreach have become major problems for the United States, as they were for Britain beforehand. The New York Times, an article February the 2nd, also last Monday, by David Sanger, titled "Huge Deficits May Alter U.S. Politics and Global Power." In a federal budget filled with mind-boggling statistics, you know, the numbers now are such you can't even comprehend them. I did read an article saying a billion hours ago, our ancestors were, in the Stone Age. I've forgotten exactly what it said, but you get my point. $1 billion sounds like nothing, but a billion hours ago was centuries ago. In a federal budget filled with mind-boggling statistics, two numbers stand out as particularly stunning for the way they may change American politics and American power. The first is the projected deficit in the coming year, nearly 11% of the country's entire economic output. That is not unprecedented. It happened during the Civil War and World War I and World War II. But now, of course, the budget deficit is getting more and more serious. For Mr. Obama and his successors, the effect of these projections is clear. Unless miraculous growth or miraculous political compromises create some old unforeseen change over the next decade, there is virtually no room for new domestic initiatives for the president or his successors. Beyond that lies the possibility that the United States could begin to suffer the same disease that has afflicted Japan over the past 20 years. As debt grew more rapidly in income, that country's influence around the world eroded. Or, as Mr. Obama's chief economic advisor, Lawrence Summers, used to ask before he entered government a year ago, how long can the world's biggest borrower remain the world's biggest power? That's a question. How long can the world's biggest borrower remain the world's biggest power? The Chinese leadership, which is lending much of the money to finance the American government's spending, and which asked pointed questions about Mr. Obama's budget when members visited Washington last summer, says it thinks the long-term answer to Mr. Summers' question is self-evident. The Europeans will also tell you that this is a big worry about the next decade. The U.S. cannot sustain its present leadership position with the financial problems that it has got. And again, let's look at some scriptures here to see where prophecy is applicable. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, keeping in mind that Israel said to Joseph's sons, "Let my name be named upon them," they were Israel. They are Israel. They still are Israel. And in Deuteronomy chapter 28, there is a promise of blessings for obedience and curses or negative consequences for disobedience. "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth." My wife and I went to see the movie The Young Victoria a few days ago. And we were so impressed with just how, you know, Victoria's character was so markedly different from the character of our leaders on both sides of the Atlantic today. There was a character in the woman, and as a result of that, it contributed to the rise to greatness at that particular time. And the same thing was true over here as well. "All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you will obey the voice of the Lord your God." Verse 4, "Blessed shall be the fruit of your body." Verse 7, the Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. and you look at the wars in the 1800s and the early 1900s, this was very much the case. Then in verse 10, all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. In verse 12, the end of the verse, you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. I can still remember when that was the case, when the United States used to lend to other nations instead of borrowing from other nations. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You shall be above only. You shall be in control because you're the one with the wealth. You shall be the head and not the tail. You shall be above only and not be beneath. If you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them. Then in verse 15, it says, it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Verse 18, cursed shall be the fruit of your body, a low birth rate. Verse 20, the Lord will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do, until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly, because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. In verse 25, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and you shall become troublesome to all the kingdoms of the earth. Just thinking about that, I read in a British newspaper when I was over there a few weeks ago, Allied troops outnumber the Taliban 11 to 1, and we still cannot win in Afghanistan. Now, 100 years ago, it was the other way around. They would have outnumbered us 11 to 1, and we would have won. But now we can't win. Verse 29, you shall not prosper in your ways. And it goes on like this about the consequences of turning away from God, which this country has done. You look back at the 1960s, the great reforming decade, or you might say deforming decade, as the country turned more and more away from God and the Bible, rejecting the values upon which the nation was built. And today we have the negative financial consequences of that, as well as the negative social consequences with broken families, broken homes, you know, and all kinds of problems as a result of that. That's a separate subject. We could look at that another time. But, you know, it is all because we turned away from God. Look at another couple of scriptures before we finish. Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. And verse 21. This verse is the key to the book of Daniel. An Old Testament prophet, and in my second presentation, we'll be looking at some things from the book of Daniel. In verse 21, it says this, that, or verse 20, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. God is behind the rise and fall of nations. You see that in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, where all the great empires of the ancient world were prophesied, revealed to Daniel in the 6th century BC. The empires that were still ahead in a time sequence. And it's also been revealed as to what the greatest powers would be at the time of the end, in the latter days. Go back to Genesis 49. I said I'd finish on a positive note because I believe it is positive. Because we have lived through interesting times. I know they say that's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. But it certainly has been interesting because when I was at school, the British Empire was still fairly intact. And Britain had more territory in Africa, for example, than the United States, more square miles than the United States had. So Britain was still a major power, and of course that changed in my lifetime. And now I see what's happening to the United States as well. It's a very interesting time to be living. But notice Genesis 49. You already saw in Genesis 48 the prophecy about how Ephraim would become a great multitude of nations, the British Empire. He set Ephraim before Manasseh. Manasseh followed Ephraim as the greatest single power, the United States of America. But Genesis 49 even mentions that France would be the greatest power before Britain. It says in verse 1, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn. my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Reuben was the oldest son. Reuben was not given the bulk of the birthright. That was given to Joseph, who was the 11th son. And then through Joseph to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. But Reuben still received a great blessing. France, the descendants of Reuben, they were the greatest power before Britain. Then Ephraim, the multitude of nations, followed on from Reuben. And then Manasseh, the great single nation, followed on from Ephraim after World War II. And now we are seeing the United States come down as well. And another great power is going to replace the United States, but only briefly, before the second coming of Jesus Christ to establish the kingdom of God. I said all this is positive. It's hard to see your own country coming down, which I think is indisputable now. I mean, you can read all these commentaries, all these historians. Neil Ferguson is one of my favorites because Neil Ferguson is often saying the same things that we say in our literature based on the Bible. But he's an atheist. So he sees these things from a totally secular viewpoint, Neil Ferguson. And I think he's a great historian. Paul Kennedy, I don't know whether he's an atheist. Paul Kennedy teaches at Yale. Neil Ferguson's in Harvard. A friend of mine had lunch with Paul Kennedy recently. You know, he's the one who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And my friend, who's a member of the United Church of God, asked Mr. Kennedy, he said, well, what do you see in the future for the United States? His response was chilling. His response was, I fear total collapse. He quickly added, I'm not an economist, he said. I'm a historian. But you know, you can look back at history and see that nations that were very prosperous, 3 or 4 years later, have collapsed into rubble. In fact, my favorite period of history is the period leading up to World War I in 1914. And those great European empires that dominated the world, the British, the French, the Russian, the German, the Austro-Hungarian. In 1913, when the Russian royal family, the Romanovs, was celebrating 300 years on the throne, everywhere they went in Russia, crowds turned out in their hundreds of thousands to greet them and cheer them on. Lenin, who wanted to overthrow them and establish a communist country, wrote to his wife in Switzerland and said, the revolution will never happen in my lifetime because the Romanovs were so popular. World War I came. 5 years later, or 4 years later, the Romanovs had been overthrown. It was the end of an empire that had lasted over 300 years. The German Empire went the same way. The Austrians, the Habsburgs, who had ruled for over 600 years. The Emperor Franz Joseph, when he died in 1916, was the longest serving monarch in European history. 68 years on the throne. Extremely popular. Nobody could have foreseen what was going to happen. But just over 2 years later, the whole empire collapsed. And you try to place yourself in that position and ask, you know, could that happen to us? Yes, it could happen to us. It happened to the British Empire after World War II. And it could happen to us too. But realize, God is behind the rise and fall of nations, and that's the positive thing. And realize that that as each nation falls in the sequence that it was prophesied to rise to greatness and fall from greatness, the closer we get to Christ's return and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And after the United States, you just have this one great final superpower which won't last very long from what we can tell in Bible prophecy. And then you see the return of Jesus Christ. So Reuben first, France first, in the 1700s, Louis XIV, culminating in Napoleon finally, and then the British, Ephraim, the multitude of nations, the great British Empire, and then Manasseh, the great single power that replaced Ephraim at the end of World War II. And now I think if you read your papers, magazines, you'll see more and more articles on who is going to replace the United States. And most eyes are focused on China as the next superpower. But they're wrong. And if you stay for the second lecture, I'll show you how they're wrong by looking at the prophecies in your Bible.